Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
You're listening to Griefcast with me, Cariad Lloyd. Griefcast is a place to talk, share and laugh about the peculiar human process of death and grief. Each week, I talk to a different person about their experiences of grief and death as we remember someone that they have lost along the way, whether it was a long time ago or you've just joined the club. Welcome to Griefcast.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey Griefsters, I hope you're having an okay week. I'm feeling good this week because I have finished the first draft of my book, You Are Not Alone, which if you don't know, I'm writing a book based on the podcast and what we talk about and what all the guests have been talking about, and I finished it. Obviously now I have to edit it, but my God, I feel pretty joyful, as you can hear. I will let you know as soon as you can pre-order it. I know some of you have been asking me. I don't actually know when you can, but I'm sure it will be soon. But thank you for all your lovely words of encouragement, as I have been moaning about it quite a lot. And thank you for your lovely words about the series so far. As ever, if you've been enjoying it, please do rate, review, subscribe, or just tell someone who you think will enjoy it. It really does help me continue to make the show. This week, I'm talking to an extraordinary person. It is the incredible Philippa Perry. Philippa is a psychotherapist, an author, a journalist, a television presenter. You will know her from watching Grayson's Art Club, or you'll know her from her book, The Book You Wish Your Parents Had Read, or Couch Fiction. She is a genuinely, staggeringly intelligent, brilliant person. So I was hugely excited to speak to her. Philippa came in to talk to me about her friend Bonnie, who passed away very recently. And we also talked about her mum and dad and her journey to dealing with the process of their deaths. It's really hard. I've interviewed a few psychotherapists, and it's really hard not to start a therapy session when I'm talking to you. Do you know what I mean?
Don't worry about that. That would be going straight into my comfort zone, so that would be fine.
Oh, yeah, that's true, isn't it? I'm asking everybody this as well, because obviously, like, how is your current lockdown? I used to be like, how's lockdown? But how's lockdown three working out for you on this snowy day in London?
I'm sort of better at lockdown now.
Oh, yeah.
Sort of rejigged all my projects. So I'm doing a lot more Zooming and less sort of writing on my own, which I find just bad enough normally, but when you can't go out to dinner afterwards, it's terrible. So I've sort of put my new book on hold for a bit, and I'm doing more broadcasting because it's more collaborative and more fun.
That's a good idea. I'm trying to write a book and it is really, you're so right, because it's so isolating. And yeah, I guess when I was writing it pre-pandemic, I would then go and do a gig. I'm a comedian, so I would then like, and then I would like laugh and be like, yay, oh yeah, life's fine, you know.
And the thing about going out and doing a gig, because I do gigs in my own way, I wouldn't call them stand up, but I do have a go sometimes, is the banter and the interaction with the audience and the ideas they give me, the questions they ask me, feeds my work. And that's all sort of dried up, obviously, the meeting the public bit. So
that's so true, isn't it? You forget the sort of interaction that happens with with an audience. It's, yeah, and it's...
Or at a party, like, what are you working on right now? Well, I'm doing this thing. Oh, really? And then, you know, they're really helpful.
I know, yeah, just things that people just casually pass. Oh, have you read that? And you're like, no. What's that? And they're like, oh, it's really famous. You're like, oh my God, quick. Yeah, all that kind of how we...
I did my PhD in this. Oh, did you? Can you come on my radio show? Like, yeah. I'm supposed to be doing a radio show about desire at the moment.
Ooh.
And normally I'd just be talking to people all the time about what their experience of desire was. And I've asked my husband once or twice. He thinks I'm hinting at something. No, I'm not.
I'm not. It's too cold. Please don't even consider it. I've got so many layers on that I'm not willing to start that negotiation.
No, absolutely.
Yeah, it's hard in that artistic. Oh, it sounds a bit wanky, but what I mean is like how much we connect with each other and that artistic interaction that can happen when not, you know, people spark your brain. I definitely took that for granted. I'd just be like, I had a chat, and then I came home. You know,
I didn't realize how important it was.
Yeah, to the work. I think especially, as you said, when you're writing, because I am writing a book based on the podcast. It's about death. So yeah, it's pretty bleak, especially when it's like this. It's like, oh my God, it's snowing. I'm researching death figures. Then I turn the news on and they say more thousands and thousands of deaths. You think, Jesus, I might have chosen the wrong topic for a podcast. But anyway, it's what it is.
I don't think you have. I think it's good timing. Good topic. Right? I think it's a very good topic.
So speaking of that topic, who are we remembering today? Or perhaps there may be more than one person.
Well, the last funeral I went to was for my friend Bonnie, who she was a woman who never complained very much, even though there was an awful lot on her plate.
Mm.
And she thought, oh, I've got a bit of backache. I think I need some physiotherapy at some point. And for her to even think that.
Yeah.
Anyway, she didn't have backache. She had cancer. She was really good at it.
Oh,
and
God.
It was only like 3 months from discovering it to her dying. And really? She was young, you know, like her oldest child, I think, was about 12.
Oh.
She had 4 or 5 children. I didn't count them. my special friend of her children was a young woman about my daughter's age, about 28. She's called Celeste. And how heartbroken those children are, you know. It's just sad.
So sad
when someone who is, you know, in the centre of her world and so important to so many people just fades away and dies so quickly. It's very sad. And one thing about a funeral for a person in the should be at the prime of her life. It's so full. I'm so glad this happened before lockdown.
I was going to say this was before everything else kicked off. So
yeah, I mean, a very elderly acquaintance of mine has recently died, and I was asked to join in with the funeral on Zoom. I just thought, oh God, no! What, crying on my own? No thanks. So, I mean, it was a very, very beautiful. She was like one of the people I met, you know, when you have a kid, you go to baby gym and you go to soft play and all this stuff. She was one of the people I met doing that sort of thing. And our husbands are both artists. So, you know, we had a double connection. And you have such a bond with people that you bring up babies together sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I met so many of the women that I used to know
in the baby groups,
the 1 o'clock club or whatever that we went to, and we sort of saw them all again, and we're all old now, well older, you know, in our late 50s and 60s, and it's just beautiful to meet up with them and cry. You know, you can't do anything else, you know. This was about 18 months ago, and you can still hear in my voice it's quite raw.
Well, yeah, and also I think it's hard, anything that did happen just before COVID, almost in normal times you would have kind of grieved and you would have maybe talked to other friends about it, and then everything kind of got swept away by, oh, well, now we're dealing with this. So that's why I think if you're grieving because you lost someone through COVID, it's unbelievably difficult time. But if you're grieving for losing someone for a different reason, it's very difficult to find the space for that grief at the moment, because all there is everywhere is COVID pandemic, everybody's upset. And it's like, well, where do you put that? Well, this is just sort of normal pain. A friend died, I'm sad. Where's the room for that? And it's interesting. I find, so obviously my dad died when I was 15. And I always find it, I remember seeing people as upset as you are about us. Yeah. And as a teenager, you don't understand. You're like, oh, they seem really sad. Oh, okay. And it's not until you get older that you realize like they understand, like family friends can see what you've lost, but you don't know yet. So you're sort of in this slightly blissful place where you don't really know what you've lost. You know, it's awful. It's not till you get older, you're like, wow, I lost this huge thing. But when at the time I remember people weeping and me thinking, oh gosh, they really liked him, I guess. Like, or like, wow. Okay. I mean, I guess they were close, because you can't conceive of it. And I wonder, I don't know, is that a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Is it just a thing that your body and your brain don't quite let you know into what you've lost until you get older and you're a bit more away from the rawness of it?
That's interesting. I hadn't thought of that, that a teenager might not know what it is she's lost. And then she'll know again in her 20s and then in her 30s. And I don't know how far you are from that, in her 40s, in her 50s.
Nearly, yeah. And having had, I've got two kids now. I had my second just before the first lockdown. And that's the biggest thing I've had to learn through therapy, is that the grief changes, continues.
Yeah.
Every time something big happens, you have to sort of reassess it. But I think as a teenager, I really didn't. I just thought, oh, this is very sad. But I didn't really know. Because you've got no experience of, oh, what dads might do. You know, you've only got currently, like, you know, he was annoying and I didn't speak that much.
I think one of the things that I imagine must be hard, as well as sort of thinking, oh, I could run him up and ask him how to change a plug. But as well as that, I expect it's quite painful being successful and not have your dad be proud of you for that.
Yeah, there's definitely that side to it. Or that, and also having spoken to so many teenage grievers, there's often, I mean, I'm not trained at all. This is like my theorizing, that a lot of teenage grievers tend to work very hard to make the person who's not there proud. Do you know what I mean? That is a driving force, a lot of them.
Did you feel that?
I think there's definitely something that drives you of like, it's so hard to explain, because it's almost insane. So it's like, oh, I need to prove myself so that they're proud, even though I fully know they're not here. But there's something
I was just thinking, my dad, I've always wanted to make him proud, right? He died about 8-9 years ago, I think. And I was never good enough. Mm-hmm. When I published my first book in 2010, and it was a graphic novel, and I showed it to him, and he went, it's just pictures, isn't it?
But,
no, not really. And I wrote another book called How to Stay Sane a couple of years later, and I dedicated it to him, actually. I thought that might work if I dedicate the book to him. You know, he went, I could have written a book, you know, but I never really had time, but I could have done it. I just thought, thank God I wasn't doing it for him, because that would have been even more of a letdown than it was.
That's interesting. Do you think there was some part of him that, I don't know what the word to you, but like, because he did want to write a book and you had, so it's like he couldn't quite give you that, you know, well done, because there was something in him that had not allowed himself to be creative.
I think, there was that, because he was quite artistic. You should see how he could arrange a woodyard. It was absolutely beautiful. He really had a good eye, but he didn't recognize it or know what to do with it. But I think what it was, he could not get out of the parent-child dynamic.
Yeah.
And so I was always the child. You know, 56, I was still a child.
Yeah.
And he would refer to me and my elderly sister as the children. And yes, quite funny, but also not funny, because there's a part of you that wants to be recognised for having grown up. And I didn't get that. And I can imagine if I'd lost him when I was 15, he might have got to sainthood status. And I might have imagined him as someone who was, you know, my cheerleader on every step of the way. But
yeah, it's definitely, if the conversation gets stopped early, it's very hard to work out what you're actually talking about, I suppose. You know what I mean? Because when you're a teenager, yeah, you're kind of having this, you're in conversation with your parents, but you sort of don't know you are. And I've said this before on the show, like when he died, I just didn't have the vocabulary. It was like, you know, trying to learn French. It's a bit you don't know. I don't know how to express how I feel that this person is gone. He definitely didn't become sainthood thanks to his general behavior before he died. So yeah, that was quite good actually. Although I think I slightly sainted him because my brother slightly, whatever the opposite of sainting is, you know, like, what's the word? There's a word, isn't it? Like my brother very much knocked him off the pedestal. So I think we both pulled in opposite directions, but I think it's quite healthy actually that we had each other's voices so that he would always be like, oh, he was awful. And I'd always be like, oh, but he did do this. And so I think it was quite helpful because every time you went too far down one way, you'd be like, he did do that. That was awful, wasn't it? That was really annoying.
You can always be angry with him for dying on you.
Oh, and I was furious. I was furious on him for dying. Yeah. And that took a long time to realize. And again, that's what I mean. When you're a teenager, you just don't understand what I know this is anger, but I don't know why or what. The concept of being angry at someone for dying takes, I think it took me, till I was in my early 30s when I finally found the right therapist and, you know, dealt with it. I want to run about psychotherapists. Did you get therapy after your dad died? Or how were you already in therapy? Like, did you have any counseling?
I had to have a lot of therapy because when my parents were still alive to cope with it.
But after
I've had about, all in all, about probably 25 years of therapy.
Yeah.
And I haven't had any now for, say about 10 years.
Oh, wow.
I know. I'm doing pretty well without it now. I did have to wean myself off because I had such a great therapist. It was quite hard, but I didn't really need to go anymore.
So you didn't feel like after he died, there wasn't a kind of shift? Did you feel like you'd rectified all the things beforehand?
It's not that I have all my issues neatly tied up box and bow. It's not that. It's that I think I've internalized now enough good therapists so that when a disaster comes along, I know how to process those feelings that for a while I have no words for. When you haven't got words for a feeling, when you've just got the feeling, then the feeling has you. When you find the words for the feeling, then you have the feeling. You still have the feeling, okay? It's not that the feeling goes away. It's just that you're more the boss of it.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Oh, so my God, that makes total sense, yeah.
So, for instance, you heard earlier that my voice broke a bit when I talked about my friend Bonnie. I might do it again now. But I feel like I'm not all at sea with it. I'm happy to remember her, and I'm happy to feel sad that she's no longer with us. I feel like I've got hold of that. Some people pretend they haven't got feelings about something as a way of dealing with it. I'm fine. If anybody came into my office for therapy and goes, I'm fine, I go, what does fine mean? Let's unpick that. Just unpack the box.
What is fine
and why is fine. we usually get to tears within about 5 minutes. The thing is about tears is that once you allow yourself to have them, they're not as bad as you feared they might be. They don't completely overwhelm me, or at least not much longer than an hour. You know, your body does get fed up with anger or tears after a while, and it's probably better to feel it and know that you can handle it than it is to stick it in a box.
Oh, God. Yeah, I think that's incredible advice, Philippa, and said so concisely that about the feeling. I definitely can relate to that. Like, well, I just didn't have words for it for so many years. So I just didn't, I just couldn't deal with it. Cause I was like, I don't know what this is. This is despair, terror, anger, sad, like it's everything.
Yeah.
And yeah. And it took me, which is so common for teenage grievers. They spend teenage years shock, 20s kind of avoidance. And then 30s, they're like, oh, maybe yeah. things are connected. So yeah. I very much hit, you know, tick the boxes of a teenage griever. And yeah, once I found the words for it, it was just like, oh, that's what it is. Like, because I think we just get so frightened when we don't understand things. And I think grief could be frightening.
We think if we think about it and try and find words or images or pictures for it, that it will make it worse. That the more we go into it, the bigger it will get. But actually, in my experience, the reverse is true. When I say my experience, I mean my experience and my hundreds of clients' experience. The reverse is true. And once we get used to talking about something and really used to it, I might start somebody off drawing about it if they can't find words. You know, what would your grief look like if we drew it? And, you know, you might draw a bird or a teddy bear. There's a wonderful book called Grief is a Thing with Feathers.
Oh, where Max Porter.
Yes, and his grief revisited him in the form of a crow, it seemed. So many people have found it helpful to find an image for the thing that they're sort of trying to get a handle on, trying to hold. Because as soon as you've got a word or an image, you've actually got hold of it in a way.
Yeah.
It's not that you don't feel anymore. It's just that you can handle the feelings.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, exactly what therapy did for me. It didn't, like, and I always say this on the show, it didn't make me, oh, I'm not grieving anymore. Oh, you know what? He died. It's fine. But it made me go, oh, okay, the feelings. Yeah, like, I suppose it's like, you know, like something in the box. And if you don't look, it gets worse and worse and worse. And then when you look and you're like, oh, it's a big monster. Okay, that's what it is. Like, right, it's fine.
It's a monster, fine. with three eyes.
Yeah, but it's like that's sort of watching a horror film through your fingers, isn't it? It's like sometimes that's worse because you don't, sometimes you look and you go, oh, actually, that special effect is really stupid. I'm laughing. And I think it's just, I definitely had that with therapy. And, you know, I'm sure she will attest to what she spent 4 years doing was basically just asking me to cry and then making me realize I would stop, because I think that's quite common with grief as well. You just think, if I start, I will never stop. I will I will cry until I'm dead.
For grief and for anger, if I let it out, I'll never stop. I'll throw all the furniture out of the window. I'll go mad. And yet what you find usually is love or something like that underneath it all.
Or just cry. I think you just cry and you're like, oh, that's all it was. It just needed attention. It needed like a kid. It's like, it just needed 5 minutes of me actually looking at it, as opposed to being like, no, hang on. I've just got to. And then it's actually much calmer, but you have to be quite, well, I think this is why for me anyway, and obviously everyone's very different. I found therapy so helpful to have someone help me through that process and almost hold my hand and be like, if it is a big scary monster, I'm here. Like, and I will be with you.
Yeah. You feel like you've got someone who's apparently trained to cope.
Yes. I've sort of felt
that's the illusion. It's you that's coping.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Welcome back to Griefcast with Carrie Adloyd.
There was something I wanted to go back to. You asked me, did I have counselling to deal with my parents' death? And that's been on the back boil of what we've been talking. And I'm thinking, I think I know why you asked me that. It's because your relationship with your father was very much unfinished.
Yes.
Whereas mine had run its course. He was 96. He had dementia. And we had such a beautiful time. Actually, after he got dementia, his sort of layers of defense and stuff were pushed away, and he sort of became more like, sort of like, will I get into trouble for that? You know, it sort of became more childlike. And there was a time when he didn't recognize my sister or I, but at the nursing home, they said, oh, he's so calm after either of you have been. And I used to sit next to him, and he would sort of slump against my body. And the nursing staff said he doesn't do that with anyone else. It's because he feels comfortable with your body, even though he doesn't know who you are. And I went to see him one day, and I think the Grand National had been on the telly. And he thought we were at the Grand National. The telly wasn't even on, but we were at the Grand National. Yeah. Sort of, how did you get up to Aintree? Did you drive or did you get the train? I went, oh, hello, I think we're at the Grand National. I said, I got the train, Dad. You know, and he's sort of like, was it crowded because of the races? And then he said, I've put £1,000 each way on this. He never used to bet like that. You'd put a tenner on anything at the most. But and anyway, the horse came in. He was a favourite, so we've only got £4,000. And I said, what are you going to do? I said, what are you going to do with it? And he said, I'm going to give it to my daughter. And I went, oh, really? What's your daughter like? And he looked at me for ages. And he said, she's a lot like you, only much, much younger.
Oh, my God.
And anyway, I told my sister this, and she said, do you think he's unconscious? Because, you know, she's been my sister for a long time, so she knows about the unconscious. Yeah. Do you think the unconscious is telling us that, you know, there's treasure hidden back? I said, it's worth a look. It's worth a look. Right. There was a safe with his old stamp collection in it. We were hoping for better. And we pulled back the carpet at the edges, and sure enough, under the floorboards, there was a secret stash of Winston Churchill coins. You know, commemorative Christ, I think this might be the fortune, I'm afraid.
I think
was also some out of date francs as well.
Wow, but that is amazing that your sister was right, that there was something hidden.
I think she'd remembered that he talked about putting something under the floorboards once as well, so it jogged the memory.
That's a really, what a sort of profound and beautiful thing to say to you, that she looks a lot like you but much younger. That's so,
I didn't know if he was sort of joking, because it was a sort of defence of his at the end to pretend he was joking, because he didn't know what was happening, and he didn't like the vulnerability of that.
Yeah. That's amazing.
It really helped me as a sort of closure. Of our relationship, really. Sort of, she's a lot like you, and he much, much longer. So I would be always this sort of child to him.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
He liked me like that. And I felt that, you know, if he had won £4,000 on the horses, he would have given it to us, you know.
Which is very sweet. It's good he didn't say to my, yeah, to the, not to my children, no, awful. Like he was like, no, to my children. You're like, good, this is, because this is the real truth coming out here.
Yeah, that's right.
I think that it almost goes back to what we were saying about your friend Bonnie, doesn't it? Of like anything where it feels interrupted, a life interrupted, there is such a pain and sadness to that. And like you said, a full funeral is a wonderful slash awful thing, because it is.
Yes.
Because, yeah, I've been to plenty of funerals when someone's in their 90s and there's a handful of people and it's, you know, like you said, it's very sad and it's never, you know, you're never like woohoo when someone dies, but also it's like, okay, you, and that relationship, as you say, is completed, finished, ridden its course. Yeah. And I think whenever someone is taken too young, it leaves a lot of complications. But I'm glad that you had that moment with your dad, in a way. It sounds the sort of funniness, not funniness, but the strange way that dementia works, that you have these moments with people that perhaps wouldn't be, you're communicating and the words are not what you're saying. It's very subtext, isn't it? There's lots of stuff going on with dementia.
That's what I love about working with dreams. It's like people's truth coming, their feelings are coming out as truth. And just because they've got metaphors instead of what they're actually thinking about doesn't make it any less true. And he just spoke in metaphors all the time at the end.
Yeah.
And I was lucky enough to be able to decipher some of them.
Yeah,
you know, like that one, winning at the races. Isn't that winning at life? Haven't I won at life if I win at the races?
Yeah.
He did have a great life. And, you know, he had a devoted wife, a successful business, things he liked doing. He had his hobbies. So, you know, it was all complete. But, you know, Bonnie was definitely a load of unfinished work.
Mm,
you know, she'd lived for her children and it's going to be her time, and she never had her time.
Mm, I think that, you know, all grief is many, you know, multifaceted, but I think there's that the pain of a grief where it's, someone was too young, or there's children involved, or it just feels like they were just about to, they were just that feeling of like they hadn't.
And the thing is, if someone is incredibly vibrant and there and alive, is that when we're, you know, two people together and we're in a relationship with each other, be that a significant other relationship like you had with your father, or a mere friendship like I had with Bonnie, if somebody goes, they take with them a sort of part of you, and that becomes a void in you. Like your shared jokes, your shared history, the moments that just you and you had together, your shared memories. It's like losing a part of yourself. And for a moment, I think grief really hurts. Part of the reason grief really hurts is because of that void and that hole in you. But over time, other things do fill it up.
Mm.
And we needn't feel guilty about that.
No, absolutely
that,
not.
That we don't keep tending the void and keeping the void going.
Mm.
That isn't a healthy thing to do. And I don't think any dead person would want you to have a gaping hole like that.
My favorite one is the ball in the box theory.
I haven't heard.
I love this for grief so much. So it's like when someone dies, the grief is a ball and it fills up your whole box, which is your life. Like all you can see is grief. And then as time goes on, your life expands and more things happen. You have memories, you've been on holiday, there's not a lockdown, but the grief stays the same size, but life continues. So your box gets bigger, but the ball stays the same. And at any point that ball might suddenly bounce up to the surface and be there. But what it does is give you permission to go, the grief doesn't disappear. It doesn't evaporate. It's there, but life has built around it. And obviously the more time, you know, so obviously I'm like 20 plus years into my dad dying, there's so much life now that it's like the grief for me, you know, is there, but most days I'm pretty fine. Like even if I think of him, I'm like, oh yeah. And I do a show and I talk about him all the time. And of course, every now and again, it will spike up and I'll be like, oh, that was a painful one, but it's very brief.
Yeah.
And I think that's sort of what we mean when we say, you know, time's a healer. We sort of mean that, but it gives people this weird thing of like, oh, so I'm just gonna be fine in an hour. But it's like, no, you really need a lot of time and a lot of life.
Yeah.
And you said if you tend the grief, you keep your box quite small, don't you? You're not allowing yeah. life to continue. And
no, you have to get out.
Yeah.
You have to have life, whether that's reading books or making new friends or going for walks or going abroad or having a great career. You have to do it.
Yeah. And as, like you said, I think it's, I'm sure most of them, you know, wouldn't want you to do that. But obviously when you're in a flow of grief, it's very hard. And when I saw that ball in the box, I was like, it was the first time I was like, oh, so I can have life and grief and those things can be, it's okay. I'm not expected to have got rid of this and tidied it away. That's fine. Yeah. And it sometimes comes up and bothers me. And I think what you said there, like that, it's really nice the way you put it, of like that void of whatever the relationship is with someone, you are in relationship with them, you know, whether it is a passing acquaintance or a colleague or a close friend.
A part of you lives in them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the part you lose.
Yeah. I interviewed a beautiful writer and radio presenter, Emily Dean, and she lost her mum, her dad and her sister very close together. And wrote a brilliant book about it called Everyone Died, So I Got a Dog, which is very funny. But her parents were very bohemian. The expression she used, which I love, was she said, I lost my witness when my sister died. So I lost the witness to this person who could go, do you remember when the person playing Doctor Who came out at midnight and we all had to get drunk, even though we had to do a play at midnight and our pajamas, and there were all these actors and comedians there, and her sister would be like, yeah, that happened. And losing your witness as well to something as well, like maybe with you and Bonnie, like you said, like the 1 o'clock club and all that stuff you've been through, it's that person who saw you, can remember those things with you.
Yeah.
And it's lonely to remember them by yourself.
Yeah. My husband once interviewed for a documentary he made this lady whose husband had Alzheimer's. And as he lost his memories, his shared memories with her, she felt she was losing them. So that was sort of like partly a sort of living death of that. I thought that was very poignant.
Mm. Yeah, living grief. And they describe that, especially for Alzheimer's, but, you know, as soon as you get a cancer diagnosis, you are living in that grief because you're all a terminal diagnosis, obviously, sorry, not a cancer diagnosis, a terminal diagnosis. And it's that's very poignant, isn't it? I guess it's to accept that memories aren't yours. Like you have yours, but actually you share a lot of memories with people, and you can build puzzles together almost, can't you? Like, oh, that happened, and you said this and you did that. And when you are by yourself, you're sort of an unreliable narrator, aren't you? Like, well, is that true? I definitely have that with my dad, because obviously it was so long ago. So there's stuff that you're like, oh my God, is that a memory, or have I invented that? Or like, has that got mixed with three holidays and one memory that I've made into this other thing? It's very, very slippy.
Yeah, it is slippy. I think there's more to it than that even. I mean, there's the actual thing of actual memories, but you are also the person you are when you're with them.
Yes,
and
that's
you
true.
Lose that person that you are with them.
Mm.
Because you can't be exactly the same with another person. You know when, I mean, I noticed this most when I had a full practice as a psychotherapist, but when one client came in, I'd have a sort of sense of the atmosphere of the vibe going on. And then another client came in and it would change, you know, the atmosphere would change. So like you have eight clients in a day and you'd be the same person, obviously, but almost eight different people as well.
Yeah.
And you know how you feel when you're with some people, you're having a really good time. And what that means, you love you while you're with them.
Yeah.
You know, because you love being with them, but that means you enjoy the sensations and the experiences you're having in your body when you're with them. And if a friend dies, we lose that very unique experience of being the us we were when we were with them. You know, they'd make you laugh in a certain way or cry in a certain way or see things in a certain way or just not even anything tangible that you can get hold of.
Yeah.
It's just the feeling of being with them. That part of you goes. You get different feelings, perhaps even better feelings, with being with other people and when you have more life. But that feeling, you know, goes. And I think the feeling a child has, you know, when they're holding a parent, you're not going to get that with anyone else.
No, it's a particular, yeah, particular loss, isn't it? And I speak to so many people, you know, people who've lost siblings or children or friends or grandparents who meant very much to them. And we always say on the show, there isn't a grief hierarchy. There's just different griefs.
Yeah.
But yeah, that the relationship of parent to child is very complicated and special and bizarre and all of those things, because, you know, you are inherited so much of yourself from these two people that you're, you know, they're responsible for you in so many ways, not just safety, but like your literal existence. So,
and also that thing of being proud of you. When a parent is proud of a child, their pride in you means more in a way than the applause of an audience or the book charts or whatever it is.
It's
sort of like, I did good. You know, it's sort of really primal.
It's like your, I sort of think it's your first audience. Your first audience are your parents. And so however you learn to what, you know, however you learn pride or approval, whatever the way they teach you, that they are the first people who laugh when you say something or say, wow, oh my goodness. Like when you do all of that stuff. So that's when either you, well, it says a lot about comedians, doesn't it? Because what didn't we get? Basically, we then went to the audience.
Why do I have to go out in public? You know, was it because he did say something like, oh, I could have written a book? I
thought, I'm going to show you. I'm going to keep showing you. So do you feel like, because obviously, like you said, he wasn't very vocal with that, but you felt like by the end that you had reached a place with him that it was okay. It was okay,
he had a belief, a mistaken belief, that if he showed his children his pride or his approval, they wouldn't try anymore. Something like that.
And he sort of
kept it up. You know, we're in our 50s, 60s now. You know, keep it up by all means. But, you know, so... yeah, when that thing happened with the Aintree race course and stuff, and I'll give it to my daughter and the winnings, I just felt he would have given it to me. But the thing is, if we're going to have a fantasy about someone, it's so much better if we can make it a good one. Like, how much more cheerful am I thinking he wanted to give me and my sister treasure rather than he was hiding his what he thought was his fortune forever so we wouldn't get it. We could make two sort of fantasies.
Two truths.
Two fantasies. And so if I had an advice for anyone, is if you're going to have a fantasy about someone else's motive, just make it a good one because you'll be so much happier.
That's so interesting. I wonder if that's like the key to happiness, isn't it?
It's a difficult switch to flick.
It is, but also I think of my friends who are very happy people, if they had like say an interaction in the shop that was, you know, someone might be a bit rude and I would say to them, what do you think happened? They'd be like, oh, they probably just had a bad day and never mind. Like, that's fine. And I think of my friends who tend more towards depression, they'd be like, this always happens to me. Like everyone's rude. And you can see that it's just like, the way people view their experiences. And you're right. Like if you can view happy motives, you know, it's much easier. Like, oh, I always think that about London when people complain, like, oh, you know, London's so busy or this, and everyone's rude. And you're like, oh, everyone's just having a really cool time and they're in a hurry to get there, like, because they're having these amazing experiences. Like,
there is a theory about that. And it's in crowded places such as Japan, Tokyo, and, you know, London, is that people have this thing where we're so crowded together that people are very respectful of everybody's individual space.
Yeah, that tiny.
So this is a good. This is a good fantasy. So it's not that they're being unfriendly; it's that they're respecting your privacy in the tube train or whatever it is.
I remember reading that about the tube, and as I was, despite my worst name, I was brought up in London, and that to me makes perfect sense. It's like, I'm not being rude. It's just like, we've all got like 30 centimeters around us. So you mind yours, I mind mine. And if you need help, we'll shout. And I've had so many friends move to London and be like, oh, everyone's so rude. I'm like, but why do you need me to say hello to make you feel better? Like, why do I have to smile for your day? Like, that's what I think London's quite good at. It's like, I got my little circle. I've got my phone. I've got my paper. I've got my book. I've sorted myself out. Why do I have to say hello to you?
Yeah,
obviously, if someone says hello, I'll say hello back. Unless obviously it's a creepy person. I mean, it works if you stay in the city. I think that's the thing. Like, my mum also grew up in London and is very London-y. And I think taught me very, like, any single kind of, any man look you anything, your first words are fuck off. Like, you don't, never say hello. And it stood me in good stead for living in London. If I had to move somewhere else, it might be a bit more tricky. Do you mind if I ask about your mum?
Ask me about my dear mother.
Yeah,
who died when my daughter was about 6 or 7, I think, and she's 28 now. So that was much longer ago. She was older than my dad, and she died quite young for our family. She died at 83, which of course is not young at all.
But for your obviously stock genes, that's good.
Yeah.
What happened?
She got food poisoning and then it became septicemia and then she died.
So that must have been very quick.
She was always ill.
Okay.
She was always ill. So, I mean, she had lots of operations and things, backache. I think she was depressed and it sort of came out in a sort of physical manifestations. And my fantasy is that she wanted to be good and kind all her life. And to do that, I fantasize, she repressed some of the self in her that she thought wasn't nice enough to be let out. And I think it got her down.
Yeah.
And I think she was a bit depressed and down. But when anyone came round, she'd pick up like this, hello, nice to see you, how marvellous, can I get you some tea, gin and tonic, what would you like? But, you know, she'd slump again when they left. My father was a very dominant personality and I think hers got a bit crushed and she didn't ever think about it or knew what to do about it, really. She was lovely. She's a very nice person. She wouldn't be anything else.
Well, that's a good thing in a way. Like, all she wanted was to be nice so that your memory of her is like, she was a really nice person.
There was a bit of martyr that would go with it. The great thing about somebody knowing you really well is they know which parent you're being when you're behaving. And yesterday, Grayson, my husband and I are about to film a new series of Grayson's Art Club. And I said, this studio is an absolute tip. We've got to clean it. So yesterday I sort of got the Hoover out and it's quite a big studio. I hoovered it, I dusted it, I mopped it. And you have to mop it about 4 times before the bucket gets clean. It took me about 3 hours.
Oh my God.
He was working away the whole time I was doing it, doing his proper art while I was doing the mopping. And I was sort of getting under his feet with the mop and he went, all right, Nance. That was the name of my mother. All right, Nance. I said, I know. He said, it's not called Grayson's Clean Studio, you know. It's called Grayson's Art Club. I went, I can't help it. But I just did like that he knew I was being my mother at that point, you know, sort of like, it's got to be tidy for the visitors. It's like, the whole bleeding country, for God's sake. Of course it's got to be tidy.
Yeah, it's too late. It's art. It's all right. It's messy. It's like, it's fine. But that innate, you've been brought up to believe that, if you show something messy, somehow awful.
He might want the whole place to look like Francis Bacon's studio, but I have a certain pride about it.
I'm sure, and Nance would have been proud that you got the Hoover out, you mopped, and you didn't just do a quick job. You did. It sounds like you did it properly.
Still feel pleased. It today in my back, actually. I'm too old for that.
There's that weird, not tension, but like, I don't know, humanity, I suppose, of knowing you're doing something because of your parents, but also being aware enough to be okay with it rather than like punishing yourself afterwards of like, oh God, yeah. I'm just being my mother, but being like, yeah, fair play. That's how I was brought up. And, you know, I think
my mother's standards of housework were pretty damn good and I'd like to keep them up.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. But yeah, it's nice that you don't then berate yourself for it or then feel, obviously you've had enough therapy and are self-aware enough to be like, yeah, you're sometimes echoing your parents in a way, and that Jason can comment on it and it's not a row. Do you know what I mean?
Like, oh no, it's quite funny. I know what yeah. he's doing. It's yeah. I mean, and he knows when I'm being my dad as mm. well. That's when I'm usually bodging something around the house.
Sort of and like, going, it's fine.
We don't need a new wardrobe. Look, I can put this stick up between these shelves and the corner and hang some hangers on it. That'll do. And he'll go, all right, Mark, you're getting a new wardrobe.
You know, that's really, I think that's really beautiful that, when you someone really, really knows you, like you say, and they can see, it's quite, you have to know when to play that card. I certainly think like there's times when, if my husband is doing that or if I'm doing it and it's like, yeah. it's not the day to mention it. Like, I'm not going to say it today, but me and my brother do it to each other quite a lot. I'd be like, all right, dad. And you're like, and that's, yeah. it's quite a good pull up. Cause you're like, oh yeah, yeah. God, I am. Aren't I? That's a bit weird. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
We are our parents. We can't, get around it. It's just good to be the positive aspects of one's parents yes. rather than the negative ones. The yeah. other one that both my parents have that I can do is like, come on, we're late. Rush, push. Like, and then why are we 4 hours early for this flight? Well, it's nice to wait here, isn't it? In Carluccio's at Heathrow rather than at home on the sofa.
Oh, I'm
my family disagree with me for some reason.
No, what you need is my mum does that and I've inherited it. So when we fly, we're so happy. We're like, yeah, let's leave 6 hours. Good 6 hours. And then we get to the airport. We're like, oh, I can relax, do some shopping. My brother and my dad were the opposite. So if it's just me and my mum, it's fine. I think you need someone on your team who's yeah. like, yeah. I agree. Yeah. Let's leave super early because it is completely pointless. But
what if we get a flat tire? Come on.
And I did.
Car breakdown.
I was very smug when I was on the Piccadilly line about 5 hours early for a flight. And there was a terrorist scare in London. It was when the Oxford Circus one happened. And they cut the tube line and no one could get to the airport. And I was like a stop so early. I was a stop away. So I just got the bus to Heathrow. And I had everyone ringing me like, oh God, no one's going to make their flight. So I was like, I mean, I could make the earlier flight. I'm here. So I was very smart because I was like, finally something happened. Yeah. Like it was yeah. worth it. It was
well
worth
done. Yeah, well finally. Done. And well done your mum for that training as well.
She's trained Fantastic. Me very well. Yeah. In sheer anxiety of being late. How do you feel about your own mortality? Is it something you worry about or you feel very accepting of it?
I'm not accepting of it. I'm very upset about it, actually. hang on, I'm 63, right? So that's only 17 years left. Or, you know, 80, you can't really think you're going to get more than that. Obviously, I hope if I'm not hurting, I live longer.
Mm.
But, you know, Bonnie, she just went, I could go the same way. I could have an aneurysm tomorrow. How do I feel about it? I feel sorry for my daughter already. Because she contacted me yesterday because she wanted to know what sort of sewing machine to buy. And who else would she ask? Who else?
No. You do. I mean, you know, I don't have that person to ask. And you just find other people. Like, that's the thing.
I suppose. And she is really good at friendships. So I don't really have to worry about it. She's got a great circle of great friends. So I don't have to worry about it. Grayson, on the other hand, I would worry about.
Mm.
I mean, would the sheets ever get changed?
What would the studio look like? Oh, gosh.
Oh, my God, you wouldn't be able to open the door. It was, oh, my God. But then he's also very good at making friends and employing cleaners, and I'm sure he'll be fine.
It's complicated. Since I've had children, the thought that I won't be there for them is awful.
Yours are very little as well.
Yeah, but what's funny for me is I just want to be here long enough to get a bit further than I did. So yeah. My standards are quite like, I'm just like, oh, I just don't want to be, I just want her to be at least in her 20s. Like, I don't want her to be a teenager. That's funny what, you know, to me, it's like,
you know, that's get that far. A really interesting line of thought, actually, because I think I had a similar thing because my parents didn't die until I was in my 50s. Mm. And I thought, I hope that my daughter's in her 50s when I go, because I am quite capable of managing without them now, and this is fine.
Yeah.
But would I have been in my 30s? Would I have been in my 40s?
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? But I think you sort of want to protect them from the pain that you know that you had, don't you? So you're like, that was painful, therefore I would like you not to experience that. I'd like you to just be further along down the line. But equally,
you're right. It doesn't hurt as much. It doesn't. Mm. It's sad. But it's not a disaster. I think it is a disaster if you lose a parent at 15 or 10 or 6 or 2. I think that is a disaster, but it isn't a disaster if you lose one at 30 or 40 or 50 or 60 or 70.
It's funny though, because the other thing is that from being a teenage griever and from talking to so many other teenage grievers, I sometimes feel like I did a talk once and a guy spoke. We were all talking about sort of life-changing experiences, and this guy spoke about his near-death experience, and he'd been very close, and he hadn't died, obviously, he was there talking. And he said in the talk, he was like, God, you know, and I thought of my daughter and what would happen if I didn't get to see her, you know, do her GCSEs or get married, go to university. And I was next, and I was sitting there thinking, I mean, that is my life. Like, I was like, it's so funny. I was like, wow.
It's fine. Look at me.
Yeah. And I did feel a bit like, it's funny when someone's worst nightmare is your life and you're like, oh. And I have a very good school friend who lost her dad at 8. And so we obviously connect in that way. And she's always like, oh, for God's sakes. When people say that, she's like, we're fine. We're fine. I mean, maybe you could unpack what fine means. But I do think sometimes that's one thing I sort of not grateful for, but it's a handy positive in amongst not a lot of negatives, in that I do know you can survive these things. You can survive losing a parent. You can, even if you're 15, you know, 15, 10, all these things, it doesn't stop. Again, it doesn't take the feeling away of the pain. It doesn't take the sadness away or the tears, but the other side of it, I guess maybe the positive fantasy, if you want to call it that, is that, you can be okay. You can be sort of roughly okay most days and still have experienced something like that.
Yeah. I think we live quite a cushioned life now, what with antibiotics and good sanitation, that we've forgotten about death.
Oh, God, yeah.
But death is all around us and ever present and always was and always will be. And it's almost like we've taken a death pill because of sanitation and antibiotics. That we've forgotten that it's here. And you know, COVID, of course, it's a tragedy. But in the Middle Ages, it would have been, oh, yeah, here we go, another plague.
I know. And I spoke to
without it being such a sort of like shock horror thing.
Yeah. And my friends who work in palliative care have said to me, we've always known you can die any minute. Like, it's like everyone's just woken up to, oh, my God, I could die. You're like, yeah, that's not new. Like, that's the case.
And we always talk in the language about saving a life. You can't save a life. You can prolong it for a bit.
Yeah.
But in 100 years' time, it doesn't make any difference if I die now or I die 30 years hence. It won't make any difference. There's another myth as well, which is like, we will never forget you. We'll always remember you. No. My memory will die when my daughter dies and I will be forgotten. And that's it. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust.
Yeah.
I will be dust. Maybe I have a little fantasy that, you know, maybe if I'm a very kind, loving person, you know, really kind and loving rather than acting it, thanks, Mum, but really kind and loving, maybe I'll pass that on to someone like my daughter, and she'll become kind and loving, mm-hmm. and then she'll pass the love on. I think, mm-hmm. isn't that what human is, actually?
Oh,
we just love each other, yeah. and we pass that on, so we learn how to love each other. Because there are societies that kind of hate each other, mm-hmm. and they're quite aggressive and sort of not community-minded. I think actually it goes 52-48% like that.
But I do think I mean, that with parents and children, I think it's a really nice way to think about death and, you know, families and children. And I've said this to other parents who are worried about their children and their mortality, is like, you know, my dad was a very complicated man. There were lots of flaws, but he really did love me. And I knew that. I really did know I was loved. And so when he died, there was obviously years of therapy and lots of things to go for, but I still felt the love. And I think that's all you can do, is love them so hard that when you're dead, they still think, I can still kind of feel something that is yeah. love. Even though I've lost yeah. that feeling of yeah. being with them, I feel their love still.
And you know you're lovable.
Yeah, that's true, isn't it? That's why it's, yeah. yeah. And then you said that if you can do that to a child, they can then be kind in the world because they felt loved yeah. and are lovable and they won't cause yeah. pain. And I think, yeah, that's why it's sort of, why parenting is terrifying. You're like, God, I could not just muck up your life. I could muck up a lot of lives if you go
yeah.
out and you haven't been like right. trained properly. Oh yeah. Well, Philip, it was so nice to talk to you. It was wonderful. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. I've had a lovely time.
Oh, I'm really glad. I'm really glad. So thank you so much for talking to me about Nance, Mark and Bonnie. It was really nice to speak about them and hear about them. Yeah, thank you so much. It was so interesting. It's always really interesting talking to psychotherapists on their.
And I think you are doing such a great job having a death podcast.
Oh, thank
people
you.
Have forgotten all about death. Mm-hmm. At the end yeah. of my book, How to Stay Sane, I put, in 100 years' time, everyone in the street you can see right now is going to be dead. And I went on to say something deep and profound. But people picked me up on that and said, that was a bit of a downer. I went,
no, it's joyful.
What? Was it news to you? God. So, you know, keep talking about death. The news needs to go out. It's going to happen.
It's going to happen.
It's going to happen.
We should leave the podcast on that note. It's going to happen.
It's going to happen, guys.
It's going to happen. You can follow Philippa on Twitter at Philippa Perry, that's P-H-I-L-I-P-P-A underscore Perry, and she's also on Instagram at The Book You Wish. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at The Griefcast. The show was edited by Kate Holland, with music provided by The Glue Ensemble, and was recorded remotely from both mine and Philippa's living rooms, respectively. Thank you so much for listening, and remember, you are not alone.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.